While everybody's taking their seats, just a little bit of introduction to Lasani. I just mentioned him before. We've known each other for quite a while. He's the pastor in Delft. We've got a church in Delft, and he's pastoring the church with his lovely wife, Bisha. Very welcome here with us this morning. This is your house.
It's my house.
It's your house now.
So I can do what I want.
Yeah, as long as you got the mic.
He said I can do what I want, so I'm going to do that. We've got a culture. I know people love culture, right? So we've got our own culture in Delft, something that we do before church. So I'm going to ask us to just stand, and then we're just going to do that, and you just indulge me for a moment. And I hope that you chose the right people to sit next to, because I'm going to be asking you to do something just now. So I just hope that you chose wisely, okay? So there's a song that we sing. And if you sing it with me, you're going to help me to relax so that I don't have to be nervous up front here, okay? It simply says, yes, I love you with the love of the Lord. Yes, I love you with the love of the Lord. 'Cause I can see in you the glory of the Lord. Yes, I love you with the love of the Lord. So I'm going to ask you to do something, but because we don't have a lot of time in Durbanville, in Delft we tend to have a little bit more time. So in Delft, and we're smaller, so you can get to hug everybody. But here we you're a lot. So you can only just simply hug the person next to you, and then you can tell them and sing that song over them and so on. Just going to take a minute, and then I'm going to sing down, all right? Yes, I love you with the love of the Lord. Yes, I love you with the love of the Lord. Thank you very much. And I can see in you the glory of the Lord. Yes, I love you with the love of the Lord. You can clap hands for yourselves and then you can take a seat. I would have loved to have all those warm hugs like the one I just received now from all of you. So unfortunately, time is very limited this side of the world. So next time, come to Delft. So there's more time. Time multiplies as you cross the N1, and then you cross the railway track there in Bellville, and then you cross the Stellenbosch arterial. So every time you cross any of those barriers, time multiplies. So you go into a time zone. But I'm here today, and we're just going to make sure that we go through what the word that we have. You know, Pastor Ross is a bit of a, you know, he comes from the army, so he's a bit of a control freak. So that doesn't sound right. But so he told me that there's a series that you're busy with, yeah. And so he even prepared the slides for me. I was like, so what am I going to preach if you prepare the slides for me and you've got a series? But I thought, nah, he won't be here, and I'll have the mic. So I still can decide what to do here. But I took a little bit of guidance, so I still use the background of his slides and so on, and one or two scriptures. But other than that, you know, because he did give me leeway, he said, but you know, when you're there, you must pitch. It must be you preaching and not me. I said, great, you know what that means. But anyway, he'll get the feedback on Monday when they have, you know, their meetings. So you'll know what happened here. So what I want to talk about today, because you know when you're reading these letters to the different churches, there are many interpretations and so on. And the one that I was asked to talk about is the letter to the church in Smyrna. I think Smyrna or Smyrna, something like that, somewhere in Turkey. And I thought, but you know, obviously, all of us would want to ask a question at the end of that. If we were to start with that, at the end of that, you would ask, okay. Oh, maybe you don't do that. Maybe you are more matured Christians than I am. But what's in it for me? You know, at the end, what is the message for me at this? What? How do I take this? Was this just for them at that time? What does it mean for me today? And so today, I'm going to be talking about the crown of life. And it was also, it's a very difficult concept even for me to understand. What is the crown of life? Because really, I mean, I'm Okay, I was born in a tribal village, so there is a chief. So in a way, we sort of understand what it means to have a crown on your head. But most of you were born in a republic, the republic, ne? You were not born in a monarchy or anything, you know. So the issue of crown may be a bit distant and so on. But those who were born in those settings may be able to understand. But the crown of life, what is the crown of life? And when I read that letter and I read other scriptures to do with that, where they speak of the crown of life, and I got to this, which I could identify with in terms of what it means, the crown of life. And then it's my topic, creating a legacy, And just to understand it more in the context of the gospel, said creating a legacy that reconciles people to God or that leads people to God. I think you tend to, if you watch a lot of movies, I mean, you've got a lot of movies where people are given a couple of days to live or they're given a couple of weeks, and then the things that matter for them then are very different to some of the things that mattered before then. So what really matters in your last days? What are the kind of things that you wish you would have done in your life? What are the things that you would like to do in your last few days? And many of those tend to be you actually want to make a difference, or you want to be there with your family. You want to make sure that you live a legacy. And that is why sometimes the worst thing that you can do for a human being is not to kill him, is to kill his children. Because that takes hope. It's like taking hope double, sort of. It's like you if you kill me, you know, you get rid of me. But you kill my children, you even kill the hope for the future. And I guess that's why when we're celebrating the baby dedications here today, and you can see the grandparents, I mean, even now some of the grandparents are holding the children, there's no pleasure that replaces that. And then I know as we become grandparents, we even regret some of the things that we failed to do when we were still like very strong young men and so on, but at least we've got an opportunity to correct some of the wrongs. It there's just something about the legacy. I mean, my parents, what they tend to do, whenever I have a child, they take away the child and stay with the child for like a couple of years and so on. They say to me that it must be like a conveyor belt, you know. It's like you produce one, they take one, and then you take the other one back, and then you must produce another one, they give back the other one, and so on. But we've not been living up to that. We only stuck at two. So this factory's got a factory fault. It's not going too far. But there's a scripture that we read, I mean, we actually sang it, and that was quite prophetic. We didn't compare notes beforehand, but Revelation 12, verse 11, they triumphed or they overcame over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Now, that's quite a deep one to read. But the two aspects to it, the blood of the Lamb, that is something that you and I cannot do anything about. It's something that was done for us. It's a free gift of salvation. I told myself that I'll just put in a stopwatch so that I can operate on, on Durbanville time. There we go. So they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of the blood of the Lamb, that was done for us. That's a done deal. That's what the cross is about. That is why no other religion can fake that one. Because it was only done that once, and that's what it is. You take it or leave it, but that's what it is. But then there's a second part to it that speaks of the word of their testimony. And I mean, that you can expand into many different things, but I think we can understand it fundamentally by either what you say with your mouth or what your life testifies. So it's something that, I can liken it to the example where it said that Jesus, he grew in stature, in favor with God and in favor with men. So that favor with men, for me, that is the definition of testimony. There's nothing you can do against that. And if you look at the lives of the people, especially in the early church, their lives is exactly what the people did not believe. That's what they hated. Those who were the Jewish leaders then and so on, they actually hated the testimony of these people. It's like you said, those that are turning the world over, they are here. You just begin, if you're not with them, you just had this hatred. And Paul, Saul, he had that. He had this, when he heard about them, he just wanted to get rid of them. He wanted to get rid of this testimony. He wanted to put them in prison because he just didn't want this to be presented to the world. He didn't want this testimony to be presented to the world. He wanted to get rid of it completely. And this is so it means that in the part of the testimony, there is a role for us there. There's a part that we play in that. There's the taking of the facts in terms of the blood of the Lamb and the things that God has done and the promises. There's the taking of that and there's the application of that in our own lives to create the testimony. The Romans 10 talks about believing in the heart and confessing with the mouth. And I guess when those two are done, the lifestyle will follow. So the victory that we will win, the victory that we are winning, stems from mainly these two things. It's what God has done, and it's what we respond, how our response to that. Taking that into our own lives and creating a lifestyle that is a testimony to the world. And I want you to understand that when we go to read what the letter was saying to the church, the specific church that we're focusing on today. So if you want to just then understand what is at stake, why was he addressing this matter to the church in Smyrna? And then I'm going to go through the scriptures to look at that. But I first want us to consider these things so that when we read those scriptures, you'll have this in mind. What is at stake? And the same question can be asked today. What is at stake today? What are the things that are going to determine whether we go north or we will go south? What are those things? So I want to put it to us that the values, and I thought, you know, I looked for a definition of values and I found a very appropriate Afrikaans. I don't know if you agree with that, you know, but it's dead wat baie belangrik is. Is that right? So what is very important for us, for any church, for the church generally, and for you as an individual, for you as a family? What is very important? What is it that is so important to you? That's what values are. And you can go through the list and you can see there's that 4x4 Toyota Baki, Deneva Iene, yeah, of the Ranger. Whatever, what is it? What is it? Or a tractor, or a bank account, or the profession, or what is it? I mean, I know, okay, we are all Christians. We can be honest today and you know, talk about really the kind of things that are available, or the property, or the furniture, or, I mean, we have different things that we can list that are actually, if we are honest with ourselves, very important. But we just need to understand that is what is at stake, the values, the things that we hold dear. The testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, the testimony of Jesus Christ, there's always going to be a reaction to it. So either you take it and you accept it, or you reject it. And I find that those that reject it, they spend the rest of their lives trying to disprove it. They understand that they must disprove it so that they can feel good about themselves. Otherwise, it's irritating. It's annoying. It's like you try to get away from it and you see a Christian. And you see their lifestyle, and it's actually the lifestyle speaks to you, but it irritates you. And that is why you would want to persecute them. And that is what has happened over in many kingdoms. Whenever the people in the kingdom, especially the influential people, and this is exactly what happened in this particular city. And when they begin to actually develop that hate towards these group of people, they find ways to get rid of them. And that's what Saul, that's what happened to him. It happened in many kingdoms until they give up. And I think that's what happened with the Roman Empire. I think right at the end, Constantine, I think he got to a place where, yeah, you know what? We're tired of feeding them to the alliance. We're tired of trying to burn them. You know what? Let's just embrace it or something like that. So the testimony of Jesus Christ is always a very, I don't want to say controversial, but it's a bone of contention throughout history. It's like you either believe that there was such a person, and that person was actually who he said he is, or you reject it. So what Islam has done, they said, yes, we believe he existed. He came on earth, but he's not God. And he's not the last prophet. Therefore, we don't go by his words. Muhammad is the last prophet. Where we go with that? So in a sense, they've done a bit of a compromise to say, no, we're not going to reject it because the evidence is quite overwhelming for us. But what we're going to reject is his deity. And I guess even the Jewish people, that's why they crucified him, is because they just didn't want to accept what he was saying. He's saying, I am. I said, that's blasphemy. We're going to crucify you for that. And that's what they did. The testimony of Jesus, even today in our lives, it's still there. And I guess sometimes when we're just going on about our lives, our professions, our everything, there is the voice that says, hello, where are you? What's happening? You know, there's always something that sometimes irritates us, and we can find all sorts of things to soothe that conscience, to soothe or to quiet that voice, but still feel good. So some would do when that voice, when that knocking begins to happen, we say, okay, now it means I must go to church this Sunday, and then they go and then they tick and they go home and say I'm fine, and it doesn't work like that. But there are many things that we do. Sometimes you just feel, okay, then I just need to pray a bit or just open my Bible, just look at it a bit and so on, because I don't know what to do with this voice. But our encouragement is to do a bit more than just that. And the last step is our faithfulness. That's at stake. So faithfulness means you know what is true, not just the facts, but you know what is true and you live up to it, or at least you try on a daily basis. There's a consistency involved here. There's a sort of a bit of a permanence involved here. It's not just you go in and out. It's a Sunday thing, and then the rest of the week you do what you please. It's a daily thing. It becomes a daily thing. It becomes something that you are accountable for. It's a choice that you've made, and it's a choice you're not going to unmake, and it's a choice that affects you every day. So these are the kind of things that are at stake, and these are the kind of things that Jesus was addressing when he spoke to that church, and we're going to go into those scriptures quite in detail. And if we look at who were the individuals in that church, there was one particular individual, and what was interesting for me was that when I had a discussion with Pastor Ross about this particular discussion, I went and I read the letter, and then I said, "Chish, I wonder who in that age represents this." And immediately the name that came to me was Polycarp. And at that point, I did not know that he was actually the bishop of this church. So I went and I Googled Polycarp, and I read about him, and then to my surprise, he was the bishop of this very particular church. I was like, So what was interesting is that Polycarp, he must have read this letter, because this letter was written by John, and it is said that he was discipled or was taught by John. So he must have read this letter. Actually, he must have preached it. So you must be very careful what you preach in church, because you may be asked to practice it more than anybody. So he must have preached this. When that letter, and we'll look at it, when he talks about you're going to go through something, but don't worry. So he must have taught that to his church. So this must have been very clear to him. The cause was very clear to him, because he had to teach it to the people. So that's why he knew that he could not escape the persecution. If the persecution is forcing him to renounce Jesus, he's not going to do it, because he knew what was at stake. He knew exactly. So his value system was already quite different. He was sold out to the gospel, and that's what he must have spent most of his life teaching this, and I guess for him it shouldn't have been very difficult to choose to do whatever at whatever cost, because the cost, it was very clear to him what the cost was. He had to teach it. So that is why he chose to be a martyr. It said that they tried to burn him at the stake. Yeah, I said what is at stake earlier. I didn't mean that stake that they used to burn people on. But anyway, that they tried to burn him there, but he actually couldn't burn. Then they took a spear and they put it into him. They probably had to make sure, because some of those Christians were very difficult to die back then. So he lived from AD 69 to about 155. So it was really very close to the age of the apostles during that time. That's why it is said that he did have any interaction with John the Apostle. The only one who they tried to burn him many times, that's what I hear. I must be very careful in a church like this to throw around these historical facts, because I know some of you have PhDs in theology and so on. And if I say anything wrong, please forgive me, okay? I'm just a wannabe theologian, but not quite there yet. But Polycarp counted the cost. He knew what was at stake. He knew that if he gives up and says, okay, Caesar is the Lord, then he would have pretty much done so much damage to the church at that point. Because then everybody would have to follow that example. And then the church would be so mixed that they wouldn't have been able to keep the true character, the true nature of the church. The same with us. The same with us today. If we give up on any element, any part of the gospel, of the message, what do we do? What impact does it have on the character of the church? What impact does it have on the potency of the gospel? And I've often read on Facebook and other places where unbelievers would accuse the church of being too materialistic, too focused on fast machines and things like that. And they would even quote and put on Facebook things that perhaps another man of God has said about fast cars and things like that. Now, how does that shape the character of the church? So sometimes it's easy to just look at it individually and say, I want this, I want to do this, but and not to think of the legacy that that creates. So once you've got this fast machine or you've got this thing, what impact does it have on the character of the church? Because sometimes even we as pastors are forced sometimes to preach what we think you want to hear. Because if we don't preach the right gospel, you're going to be sending us emails and stuff like that and wanting to walk out of church and so on. So in a sense, you know, there's a temptation to even beat down the pastors to actually preach what people want to hear. It's kind of things that are happening. But what happens to the character of the church if the pulpit cannot deliver, proclaim the message as it should be? What happens to the true nature of the church? It becomes a church that panders to the needs of the people, rather the wants of the people. And this is what this letter addresses. So, in terms of the value of values, die waarde van waardes, the value of values, why are values so important? And what kind of values am I talking about? I'm talking about total commitment to God. You know that sort of mind, soul, and spirit, and, you know, with all. The total commitment with everything. All your material, everything that you have. The total commitment to neighbor. I hope that we're not at a point where we'll be asking, who's my neighbor? Because they asked Jesus that question. That's a topic for another day. Total commitment to the Great Commission. And in terms of the total commitment to neighbor, I just, you know, when I heard about the words that I heard that Gandhi once said, I've read the Bible and I like the message, but the Christians, I don't know. I don't see the integrity between the message and the Christians. I just hope that that's not what people out there are saying about us as the church. There's a difference between Jesus and the church. So we wonder whose children they are. We wonder who's their God, because they seem to be quite different to the God that they talk about. And that means that to unbelievers out there, our testimony is weak. It doesn't bring conviction. It doesn't have substance. And therefore, it can never have the hope to change society because it's failing to change itself. And that is what our actions, the sum total of our actions, they impact the nature of the church, the character of the church, and therefore the testimony of the church. And if there's no testimony, and the testimony of the church is supposed to be the testimony of Jesus, and therefore if the testimony of the church is different to the testimony of Jesus, we're in a crisis. Because there can never be the kind of transformation that God wants to see in society through the church. Because in a sense, then the church is like the world, only worse, because it claims to be true. That is why politicians have taken advantage of this and they said religion is the opium of the masses. That's what Karl Marx said. And we could argue with him, but if you actually look critically at it, it is. Religion gets people to do things that are actually sometimes like, why on earth did we do that? Sometimes we sit here and we read history and we're like, why did they do that? But they believed they were doing the right things. They were told that these are the things to do. And not enough of them questioned what was being said, even from the pulpit. Because the pulpit had given into the pressure that they got from other quarters. So when our children, our grandchildren, one day read more about Jesus, they will look at us and our example and say, why didn't they do anything? Why did they not challenge that? Why did they not show a better example? Why did they not get involved? And those questions that our grandchildren or children might ask in 50, 60 years' time, we need to ask ourselves those questions today. What is it that we are omitting to do? I think that every church needs to appraise its own commitment to these values. And these are just perhaps minimum, but they do encapsulate quite the important aspects. The alternative to embracing these values is what I call the seduction, the money seduction, the power seduction, the pleasure seduction. And it's only a seduction because it's nice and good. I've always felt to myself, goodness, if the devil comes to me the way he looks in some of the comic books, I probably won't give in to that because he's ugly. I mean, he's lilac. I won't embrace that. I won't be tempted by that. But if, I guess if he comes in a form of something else, he might just get me. So seduction is only powerful if it's actually attractive. If it actually makes sense sometimes. That's when it is a seduction. Otherwise, it's something ugly that is shocking that you can just reject. So it may be easy to say, no, I'm above board when it comes to this. But if we look deeper, we may find that a lot of us are easily being seduced by these things. Easily. How often do we discuss money as opposed to how often we discuss the commitments that I spoke about? That is just a test. I remember I was sharing with a couple of gentlemen that I spent time with on Friday that there was a time when I was sharing in a setting and I said, look, inside of you is like a battle happening between two dogs, and the one that will win is the one that you feed the most. And in terms of values, it's like that. What you value the most, you pay attention to. You look after it. You invest time in it. You invest money in it. And so on. That is what it's about. So it was clear to me that in the case of somebody like Polycarp, he opted for the higher road. He understood the cause. He understood what it would require. And he was willing to make a sacrifice there. And I say that in terms of the value of the gospel, although salvation is free, and salvation needs to be free because people need to know they don't need to bring their goats when they come to God. They can somehow just come. They don't need to be clean and squeaky clean before they come to God. They somehow must just come as they are, and you'll fix that. So therefore, in that case, salvation is free. Jesus paid the price. It's paid. So we don't need to be all religious around it. It's just the facts. He has paid the price. But the proclamation of the gospel, there's a price to that that we must pay to proclaim the gospel. What do I mean by that? If you go back into history, look at the missionaries who went to foreign lands to preach the gospel. Did they pay a price? They did. Some of them with their lives. Some of them with their families and children and so on. You can talk about the Jim Elliots of this world. Many. And even today, there are many that are still paying the price. So the proclamation of the gospel, there's a price to pay. Almost all of the 11 or so of the disciples paid that price. And in this case, Polycarp also paid that price. So, in a sense, main point being the proclamation of the gospel itself is not free. It's costly. Even financially it is. We know that. But it costs a lot, even life itself. And therefore, in society, and that is where we are, our primary goal is to win people out there. That's why we exist as a church, is to be salt and light. Now, in that process of being salt and light, we need to build. To be salt and light, you have to have credibility. I mean, if salt is not salt, it must be thrown away. If light is not light, it must be chucked. So if our role is to influence, we must have credibility. They must want to buy the product. They must want to listen to us or to hear the message, even if they're irritated by it, but they must know that whatever these people have is powerful. And when I decide to hear, I want to go to these people because I know that it's powerful. There must be credibility. Now, in building that credibility, there's a cost to it. It'll cost us time. It'll cost discipline. That is why by coming to Bible school, for instance, just an example, it's a cost. But it's a cost that somebody, you as an individual, you need to pay that price so that you can grow in knowledge, so that you can grow in stature, so that you can grow in credibility. Because otherwise, if you don't invest time in that, you cannot string up a debate with some people. You cannot explain to somebody who's got questions. So you need to pay that price so that you can grow in stature. That's just an example. They spoke about the encounter course here, Liberty 4 and so on, which I know some of you will need to pay the price, more than just the 170 rands, your time, to go there. Why? So that you can, certain things that are maybe a stumbling block in your life that are actually affecting your testimony can be dealt with so that you can be free and your testimony, the value of your testimony just goes up like a share price. I know you guys understand that language better. Huh? I did some research on you guys. Realize now these are the kind of things I must say. Get them excited. And then setting up the institutions for the propagation of the gospel is costly. Like this building has to be rented and paid for. That's costly. You're paying for that. And you're going to be paying for my petrol back to Delft, right? It's costly. So there's a price to pay. And these guys understood that. I think that it is a seduction to think that there's absolutely no cost to being a Christian. Jesus paid it all. We know that. So that we can pay it forward. Unless this becomes a core value in our Christianity, we'll have no enduring testimony in the world today. Now let's go to Revelations 2, verse 8, and then I can actually just highlight these things that I've just mentioned. And to the angel, starting from 8, and to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. So, only one that I know died and came to life again. And it's not Muhammad. There's only one that I know. It's not even their ancestors. There's only one that I know. And his name is Jesus. He's the one. I know your tribulation and your poverty and the slander of those who say that they are Jews. Those are the ones who were irritated by their testimony. So they are the ones that were dragging these people to the Caesars and the courts and the councils and so on. Because these people were irritating them with this message of this Jesus. but that this of the synagogue of Satan calls them. Do not fear what you're about to suffer. That's a message that Polycarp had to teach many times. Do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may test it. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. They had to count that cost before they were killed or martyred or thrown into prison. What is the cost that you and I have to count today? And verse 11 says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. I think for me, if I have to talk about what is in it for me, okay, there could be other things, but the one thing for me that's in it for me is that second death part. That one annoys me a bit. That one I don't want. I don't want to face that second death. I don't know about you. That one is enough for me to get me say, you know what, God, let's talk. Let's negotiate this thing. What do you want me to do? Just that one. Just so that I can avoid, so that I cannot be hurt by the second death. For me, that is persuasive enough for me. I'm willing to talk. I come to the table and say, let's talk. My card's on the table. That one. We know that these letters were written to quite a number of these churches, and you can see how where Smyrna is, and so how sort of it looked like quite incredible buildings and things like that. A lot of things were happening. There were a lot of temptations during that time as well. It was, you can see if you looked at the map, it was very close to the port, and a lot of merchants, and things were going well in that area. And there were temptations, there were professions, there was money being made and so on. And these Christians were actually being excluded from some of this activity because of their testimony. There was a lot of suffering that was happening. There was poverty even because of the testimony. And some of the things are things that we're not experiencing today in this part of the world, but there are Christians that are going through the very same thing now in other parts of the world where they are actually shunned because of their testimony. And now for us, right at the end, in conclusion, so I've stuck to my time, but I think we have some time to do some ministry work here. At the end, it's like, you know, I think that one needs to be quite honest about these things. You know, we sometimes separate our lives. We compartmentalize our lives into spiritual, Sonntag, and the rest, Maandag, and so on, where we do other things. But I think we need to be quite intelligent, and we're very intelligent. I'm appealing to your intellect here. That's why I'm saying, let's do the maths. Let's count the cost. And not sort of fool ourselves thinking, I'm okay and I'm doing this, whereas we're not appraising our commitment to the values. So there's definitely a cost. There's a cost to following Jesus. There's a cost to discipleship. And if anybody, including me, comes and stands here and tells you there's absolutely no cost, they probably may be mixing two things. They're talking about the sacrifice on the cross and so on. Yes, for that, Jesus has paid it all and you have to own that. You have to take it and appropriate it. But there is a cost to being a disciple. There's a shift in values. There's a shift in priorities that must take place when you come to Christ. That is why when he spoke to one of the other churches, he said, your first love, I'm no longer it. So it means that I'm no longer the priority. I'm no longer high on top of your value list. I'm at the bottom, and that's a problem. So all of us have to appraise where we are in terms of our values. So there is a cost. But there is a reward. And, you know, there are descriptions that are given of when we get to heaven one day, I'll be wearing a bigger crown than somebody else and so on. I don't know. That doesn't appeal to me that much because I cannot see that far. I'm sorry. I'm a very practical guy. I don't see it like that. Somebody said to me, well, I won't care whether you have a bigger crown because anyway, when we get to heaven, sin will be out, so there'll be no jealousy. So you can wear your big crown, it's fine. I just want to make it and get there. I was like, sheesh, you got a point. So it's like driving a Mercedes-Benz in heaven. It won't have as much value. Because the value you get from driving a Mercedes-Benz is that you're better than other people, isn't it? Yeah? Let's be honest. So if everybody had a Mercedes-Benz, probably wouldn't mean much, right? Not anymore. Chuck your Mercedes-Benz away and so on. But I think what for me that I associate with here is that, but the legacy of faithfulness that I want to have when I go out, when I bow out, I want to live a legacy of faithfulness. I want them not to lie at my funeral, but to speak the truth and say, this man, this is what he did. This is what he meant to us. I was attending a graduation at a cooking school. It's somewhere in Cape Town, but I was attending the graduation at the Blowfish restaurant. And this man, a white man, no how, from the U.S., a Yankee, from the U.S., a filmmaker. So he came to South Africa. He said he came to South Africa to have fun. I don't know what kind of fun he was talking about that can be heard in South Africa. But anyway, he had come for fun. And he went to Khayelitsha. And he saw the poverty there. And he felt, I have to do something about this. And he doesn't speak of whether he's a Christian or not. But he decided to do something about it a little over 7 years ago. So he had to find something that he loves and something that can help create jobs. So he thought of a cooking school. So he's now put through about 20 classes of young people, over 250 young people through this school. And somebody that I knew started doing it in January, February, so started attending there. And these kids were giving testimonies, there goes that word again, about the impact that this school has had on them. Many of the girls that are there, they already had kids before. People do have kids out of wedlock. Do you know that? It happens. A lot of them, all of them almost. Even the one friend that we know, she also had a son. Many of them, you can see that the relationship with their fathers is not there. They were saying to this white man, you are my father. And they were hugging. I was crying myself nuts. I was, I got a weak heart. I'm glad my wife wasn't there because she would be looking at me all the time to see whether the first tear is going to drop. So I was like, I just waited for my son to go away to go and play with the other kids so that I can actually take my glasses off and start like dealing with the eyes and so on. It was so, so touching to hear that, to hear them speak of, and then the one gentleman, he dropped out a while ago, more than 18 months ago, but then he got a job in a restaurant, and so he came back to them and said, I now have a job, and so on. They said to him, if you can hold this job for 3 months, we'll give you a certificate. So he was there to receive his certificate. He hugged that man for maybe 5 minutes, and he was just sobbing. He was crying. And this other one was saying, I was at home for a very long time. I had no esteem, nothing. And she also could barely give a speech as well. And that was a story for each and every one of those young people there, young South Africans, young black South Africans, young colored South Africans, and even Zimbabweans and guys from Swaziland and so on. And I was thinking, my goodness, here is this American guy, and he's creating such a testimony. They were saying, you are our father because of what you've done. Here we find family. Here we find support. And at one point, the one chef was giving a testimony. She said that there was a point where they were in sort of almost about to give up. And this man said to them, guys, let me remind you of something. I have nothing. I don't have a wife. I don't have children. I only have you guys. The three of you. Those are the chefs that lecture, who also went through this program first. He said, you are all that I have. The three of you. And the one was saying that when she's out there, when she's about to take a drink, those words, bage, the words that man mentioned. So he has invested his life in them, everything in them. And that gave them value, these young people. And the question that I have for us is that, what value are we creating for other people? Let us stand. Let us stand. This is that time where we get a bit emotional, you know, we're getting a bit in touch with ourselves and where we are and our priorities and so on. And I know that it is in the heart of every human being to have a legacy. That's why we saw the grandparents here. That's why I saw them smiling. I saw them happy because of the legacy. Those babies that we dedicated today, they represent a legacy. They're probably more special than the pension, the RA from Sanlam or something. Those kids are probably more precious. At the end of the day, it's as if this is what it's about. I know when I look at my parents, it's the same. I can see that joy on their faces. And I'm saying, and this is what I get from this letter to Smyrna, that there is a greater cause. There's a greater cause. And we are responsible for shaping the character of the church in this age, in our church, where we are. That it will not be a church that is known for being materialistic, a church that is known for being selfish, a church that is known for not caring, turning the blind eye, a church that is known for walking by, but it will be a church that is known for caring, a church that is known for getting involved, a church that is known for not compromising, a church that has values that the world would like to emulate and copy, a church just that is like Jesus Christ, its founder. It resembles him in every way. People get healed, people get restored. People get given hope. If a cooking school can give people hope, how much more the Church of Jesus Christ? How much more the Church of Jesus? Does it have to take an American to come from a foreign land to come in and do what the church is supposed to do? Give hope to those that are hopeless over the end too on the other side? But even here where we are, there are such people. There are the needs here. The church is the church everywhere. I'm not going to ask you to come forward today unless if you really feel the need to. But I just want you, where you are, to just reboot your value system. Just reboot it. Just press. My boss was saying to me the other time, I said, "Yish, my laptop is slow. It's struggling. It's not... It's just not calculating things fast enough." And he said, "Reboot it. Did you reboot it?" I said, "No." He said, "Reboot it." And I did. And it was working fine after that. And I think that some of us just need that. Just need to just switch off and switch on again. And when we switch on again, the values will be in the right order. And that will be the values we will live by for the rest of our lives. So I just want to pray with us, and I want you to pray with me as I pray. And if you're still here and you want prayer, I'm going to ask the elders if any of the people come forward for me to pray for you, and the elders will do that. But all of us, we just need to pray with me. Father God, we come before you this morning. We want you to be the priority in our lives. We want our lives to reflect that. You've called us for a purpose. And when you return to earth, you will find faith in us. We will be walking faithfully with you. We want to thank you, Father God, for your mercy and for your grace. We commit ourselves to the pure word of God and never to compromise it. We will encourage our pastors to preach the pure word of God and not to preach what our ears itch to hear. We commit ourselves to support the work of the ministry. We commit ourselves to create a testimony that will lead people to you. In Jesus' mighty name. Hallelujah. Amen. So if there's anybody who just wants specific prayer, you just feel that you want to do some business and you just want to be accountable and pray about that, you're welcome to come forward so that I can pray with you. And I'll also hand over to the elders here so that they can give guidance for what is to happen.